Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 18, for Wednesday, July 4th, 2007. Nanobiotechnology. And happy 4th to our American listeners. Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audible.com/twit today for details. Let me see. audible.com/twit equals free book. That's great. That's great.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
It's time for Futures in Biotech, and Marc Pelletier is here, and we're going to talk about big biotech once again. And what is the INBT?
The INBT is the Institute for Nanobiotechnology. And it's at Johns Hopkins University, and we have the director and the associate director, Peter Searson and Dennis Wirtz.
What are they up to? What is the plan here?
Well, what their main goal is to really think out of the box and apply it to medicine, apply engineering of material sciences and biotechnology, that is, you know, biochemistry, genetics.
It's wildly interdisciplinary. I mean,
that's the power of this institute. And what they're really looking at is developing methodologies that will be applied to medicine, not 5 years from now, maybe 10 years, but certainly in the scale of 20 to 50 years from now.
Well, that's not unusual. Everything we talk about on this show is decades out in most cases.
Traditional biochemistry can get a drug to market, you know, in 5 to 10 years. Creating a drug that'll bind to a protein inside your body is not that difficult. Getting one that's not toxic that'll still do the job is, you know, a little bit more difficult, but, you know, it's definitely doable. And as you can see, the pharma industry has all kinds of different therapies for various diseases.
Right. But these getting guys, one that's smart enough to diagnose the disease
smart.
And then fix then, the disease.
Yeah, that's just
pretty amazing.
So, yeah. So Peter is a professor at the Department of Materials Sciences and Engineering, and Dennis is a professor of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering, and also of Materials Sciences and Engineering. So these two guys, you put two heads together, or you put 75 heads together, and what you
they're
get.
They're not biologists. That's kind of interesting. They're,
yeah,
they're,
a little bit of
they're
both.
Engineers.
Okay. What, there's been no other training place where one could get
the
training in nanotechnology and biotechnology. So this is what these guys have thought about and put together, and I think they're going to make quantum leaps ahead and over the next 50 years. And
well, without further ado,
finding out, yeah,
let's head to Baltimore and Johns Hopkins University and the Institute for Nanobiotechnology. Peter Searson is the director. Denis Wirtz is the associate director. So we're okay. So why don't you start, Mark?
Our guests today are Peter Searson and Dennis Wirtz from the Institute for Nanobiotechnology at Johns Hopkins University. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Mark.
Let's start by defining, you know, what is nanobiotechnology? I mean, this is an absolutely new field and one that I'm very little familiar with. Maybe, Peter, you could tell us a little bit about nanobiotech. What is it?
I guess a working definition that we've been using is just the application of nanotechnology to solve problems in healthcare and medicine. And I think that's obviously very broad, which is fine, and encompasses a broad range of activities, but under the general goal, as I said, of solving problems in healthcare and medicine.
You guys set up a new institute at Johns Hopkins. How did you guys get that together, pull it all together, basically?
It's certainly been a major effort. It's taken us, I think, about a year and a half or so with Denis and I and several other faculty members in different divisions here. I think the institute, the idea of the institute came about with the realization that solving these kind of problems with the mission that we have, again, using nanotechnology in or exploiting nanotechnology in biology and medicine, is related to solving very, very complex problems where we need to bring together faculty with expertise in material synthesis, fabrication, surface science, molecular engineering, right the way up to the cell biologists, the people doing animal studies, and ultimately the clinicians. And I think one of our major realizations is that universities really aren't well configured to address these kind of problems. You know, universities are configured by departments and schools based on the evolution of the educational system, and that we're just not well configured to address these kind of problems. And that's been the major challenge to us, is to figure out ways of getting faculty and students working together on these very, very complex problems across many disciplines.
So you're saying that universities, the way they're set up, just aren't multidisciplinary?
They're not configured in a way that makes it easy for multidisciplinary teams to get together.
So let me really large teams we're talking about. We're talking more than two or three faculty. We're talking more like maybe right. 10, even 15. And not one department could really operate and have an infrastructure that would allow for in very easily faculty to come together and work together. The incentives, the financial incentive, and also scientific communities are really not organized that way. What still is the drive is to excel in one discipline, maybe two or three, but if you want to tackle difficult problems like cancer or cystic fibrosis, some of the goals that we have in the institute, you have to bring together real experts in sometimes very seemingly disconnected fields. And that's what the institute is able to do, is to lower the barriers to bring together these researchers who wouldn't be talking to each other because, again, there's no financial incentives recognition that could occur in a single type of scientific society that would reward people truly working together and solve big biomedical questions, and we have to be aware of this, that we're still working in a world that is very disciplinary and disciplinary based. But at the same time, you know, if we want to make some real inroads in solving and developing cures for some cancers, I think we're going to have to bring people together who may not be talking to each other without such an institute.
There's 75 faculty members in the Institute for Nanobiotechnology. What disciplines are we combining?
We, in fact, have more than 120 faculty at Hopkins involved in the institute, ranging from faculty in our Division of Arts and Sciences here, in chemistry, physics, biology, biophysics, and math, in many of the engineering departments, in many of the departments in the School of Medicine, from physiology, oncology, radiology, and so on, and several departments also in the School of Public Health here.
Does everybody speak the same language? Like molecular biologists tend to have a language of their own, and
right, that's actually a good question, and that's been the motivation for at least two of the graduate training programs that we have here is to address that very issue. In fact, Denis is the PI on a Howard Hughes Medical Institute training grant, and maybe I'll let him say a few words about
the goal of that the goal of that training program, as well as another training program funded by the National Science Foundation and headed by Kate Stibbe here in chemical engineering, is really to train the next cutter of students, both in the biological sciences and in the physical sciences, really to lower these problems of communication that do currently do exist. It is very difficult for biologists to really enter and develop new, for instance, quantum dots or magnetic particles that would be of use to him or her, and even being unaware of such possibilities, and vice versa. A lot of physicists and engineers are a little bit intimidated by the biology and the seemingly huge amount of information you have to even get started. And these training programs, one goal is really to create maybe a common language, but also improve the skills so that those students that would also help then faculty collaborate, because one requirement of those graduate programs is co-advising. And one of the two co-advisors should be a life scientist and the other should be more of a physicist, chemist, or engineer.
I really think that the next generation scientists coming out of such a co-supervision would have a fantastic set of skills spanning everything from one PI and the other PI. Are you finding that students are really focusing in on one or the other, or can you really generate scientists with the ability to manipulate materials and down to the nanotech level, and then combining some fantastic genetics and biochemistry on top of that? Maybe some examples of projects. You know, what is nanobiotech? I'm still a little unclear.
Peter,
so two-part question. Let me address the first part of your question first. Figuring out how to train people in this area is an evolving process for us. We envision, as Denise said, people coming into the program, which is already happening with say, a medicine or life sciences background, and part of the training programs will expose them to some of the basic physics and engineering concepts associated with materials, fabrication of materials, patterning, and so on, so they can actually talk to people with expertise in that background about specific problems and understand what can be done and what can't be done. Similarly, for students coming into our training programs with engineering or physical sciences background, they learn some of the basic cell biology so they can talk to the people with the life sciences and medicine background and really understand the key problems that need to be addressed and to figure out how they can bring their skills to bear on those problems. So we envision this as being a learning process. Some of the things that we think are important, as Denise says, are co-advising, and down to simple details like the way we're working at the moment is that students have the two co-advisors, and they attend group meetings in both groups, and they're fully functional members of both research groups, which of course, as you say, I think has tremendous advantages. It puts some burden on the students, but the initial generation of students into our program seem excited about doing this and certainly up for the challenge.
What is your vision at the Institute? What kind of nanobiotechnology projects are you working on? What are the, with an example in terms of either diagnostics, therapeutics? Could you sort of talk us through, first of all, why do you call it nanobiotech? Is it rather than just biotechnology or material science?
I think the nanobio, as I say, we view as just applying some of the ideas of nanotechnology to problems in biology and medicine.
But the emphasis always, at least at Hopkins, is really the end game is biology and medicine. Clearly, many universities have developed expertise in nanotechnology, but we are in a unique position at Hopkins to really tap into the well-known and well-renowned expertise in the clinical and the life sciences that allow us to now more readily attack some of those problems where we think that nanotechnology could be, if not the answer, but part of the answer of to develop therapeutics and diagnostic tools. And but I think a good example is the case of cystic fibrosis, where Kelly Hopkins has expertise. There's a center in cystic fibrosis, and I think that Peter can explain a bit better the example, where it is clearly there's going to be involvement of many scientists and engineers and clinicians who are going to work together to develop and hopefully replace current therapies that are really very primitive, one can say. Why don't you go ahead, Peter?
Okay, yeah. So the example of cystic fibrosis, I think, is a good canonical example, if you like, of how nanotechnology can be applied to these kind of problems. And it also highlights the complex nature of these problems and the issue of configuring faculty to address these problems. So in developing strategies for, at least for gene therapy for cystic fibrosis, one wants to be able to deliver the CFTR gene to the lung. And in general, strategies that teams of faculty here at Hopkins are working on are in developing polymeric nanoparticles that are the basic carriers or the vehicles to deliver the gene. So we have faculty with expertise in polymer science who are working on synthesizing the particles in the right size range and so on. Since the particles are delivered by aerosol, there's also a component of understanding the aerodynamics of the particles in actually getting into the lung and getting into the right part of the lung and so on, which is related to size and mass and so on.
Aerodynamic studies on nanoparticles? How big are these particles, and how do they compare to, say, a viral delivery system?
Well, this is there's many considerations that go into these systems. These particles are typically on the order of microns, or so, at least in these particular studies. As I said, they have to be aerodynamic, but also once they get inside the lung, they encounter the so-called mucus barrier. So the lung typically wants to reject any foreign bodies that get in there. So here we in the team working on this, there's faculty who are experts in surface engineering who figure out ways of modifying the surface of the particles so that they actually embed in the mucus layer and are not expelled out of the lung. So once the particle system is designed to be aerodynamic, to get in the right part of the lung, it's surface engineered to be able to embed in the mucus layer, which involves different skills again. Then there are faculty doing in vitro studies, looking then at the efficiency of delivering the CFTR gene within all these other constraints. Then this goes on from in vitro studies to groups of faculty who are actually looking at animal studies, and to the extent, as Denis already mentioned, the Cystic Fibrosis Center is involved here and are looking towards clinical trials. So I think that this is a good example, again, of the complex multidisciplinary nature of these problems. We need to have faculty with expertise in polymer science, surface engineering, in molecular engineering, the ability to attach the CFTR gene to the particle, as well as to be able to modify the surface to embed it in the mucus layer, faculty doing the in vitro studies, faculty doing animal studies, and all the way to clinical trials.
So we need also radiologists, we need immunologists to make sure that, of course, those nanoparticles don't create run avok and creating all kinds of immunological problems. One key aspect of these studies is that we want a quick turn around. If these nanoparticles are not panning out, we want teams working with one another who can really very quickly go through different of several iterations, so that we don't wait 10 years to realize that the nanoparticles that meet some of the criteria but not other criteria just don't work, and so that's good, can happen when students really work very closely with different groups and can really make sure that different possibilities expertise I explored very quickly, and so we can go through many different possible products without waiting for the final answers to come out.
So are there examples of nanobiotechnology in medicine being used right now, or is this really bleeding edge? And how long do you think it would take before we could see gene delivery systems using nanoparticles?
I think many of these systems are under development at the moment. Some are further along than others. For example, the team working on cystic fibrosis here, I know, have completed their first series of animal studies recently. And then, obviously, it depends on the way the FDA system works and so on before technologies are approved, which can be obviously very lengthy. But I think it's certainly possible that that many of these developments will see applications and will be used clinically in the next few years.
Are these nanoparticles sort of like little buckyballs? How do you synthesize them? What kind of materials do you use? How do you engineer these?
The types of particles that can be used for carriers or vehicles, if you like, for either delivery systems or diagnostic purposes, can range from polymeric materials to inorganic materials to metals and so on. Depends on the situation. I think one of the other intriguing aspects now is there's many people across the country and around the world are now beginning to look at the notion of multifunctional particles. So looking for ways to be able to take a particle that maybe has a couple of different segments along its length, let's say, where one can attach both, say, a cell targeting agent as well as a drug to be delivered, for example. So one can start thinking about what people have been calling smart pills, for example. One can also imagine the carrier vehicle itself having reporting capability. For example, if the particle contains a magnetic component with a magnetic signature that can be either detected or imaging using a diagnostic technique, one has the capability then of targeting a particle to a particular tissue and to be able to track where it's going and to be able to deliver a drug, for example. So these kind of multifunctional particles, I think there's many different systems under development at the moment that could lead to some exciting breakthroughs in the future.
And in terms of nanotechnologies, the Institute is exploring nanoparticles, and those can be of very different shape. They don't need to be only spherical. They can be nanorods, nanowires, nanoshells, but also genetically encoded, if you will, reporters. And there's members of the Institute are also including faculty using, for instance, directed evolution to generate very and multifunctional proteins that can attach again to some subcellular organelle, can deliver a drug in a very targeted fashion, and report on the state of the cell, for instance. And multifunctional proteins, multifunctional nanoparticles are two of the platforms that faculty in the Institute are exploring to use in the context of disease, human disease in general.
Did you say targeted evolution?
Directed evolution.
Directed, okay. I'm writing that one down.
Targeted evolution is a good one.
Okay, directed evolution.
Think about it.
So how do you go... You generate proteins using directed evolution, and
right, and by directed it means that it's you start with an educated choice of a domain, and you try to append to that domain another domain that could maybe upon binding to a certain ligand, it can be a small molecule like zinc or some secondary messenger such as PIP2 or calcium. And upon binding of that messenger, there could be a conformational change occurring in the first domain. But to enhance the response, one has to try tens of thousands of variations of that proteins. And so people are using some sort of accelerated evolution to ensure that they can find an optimum protein that doesn't exist normally in nature, but then will be still encoded, genetically encoded, and produced by the cell. And so now the gene that would code for this multifunctional proteins would have to be appended to maybe again a nanoparticles, and then there's issues of delivery of this nanoparticle targeting to tissues and organs. And again, this already illustrates that a protein engineer cannot work alone. It has to immediately think about working with a drug delivery specialist and working with clinicians to ensure that what they're doing is clinically relevant. So right away, you can see that I think science is evolving in that direction. We cannot work in vacuum. We have to work as teams. And that's the challenge, not lose one's expertise. And so how to manage that is a real issue. Because if you have a bunch of journalists who are all nanobiotechnologists, then where do you find the expertise in aerodynamics? Where do you find the expertise in surface science? So, and that's something that we're going to have to think about and organize in the institute to make sure that we're not again all becoming rather journalists.
Well, I still want to get back a little bit to this directed evolution. So, you would apply a library of genes to into these nanoparticles and then look at, try and set up a condition that would select for particles that would then
either they can be viral particles you're trying to involve so as to express on the surface very ligands which have a higher affinity to for instance cell receptors on the surface of some activated T cell, for instance. Or what I was thinking of is what our colleague Marco Stomeyer, a member of the institute, is doing is really working with proteins, and where he start with for instance, if you want to create a sensor for zinc, intracellular zinc, what you can start with is a little bit of a part of a protein, a domain of a protein that would have a very high affinity with zinc, and then append to that part of this domain another domain that would basically regulate the affinity of this zinc binding domain to zinc, and that could become, say, fluorescent upon binding of zinc to the first domain, and that can be done only if you have what happens is that you can produce a first example of a protein, but that is typically doesn't work, or it can be expressed in large quantities, or this, and so you want to have tens of thousands of examples that then you can optimize, for instance, to make sure that the fluorescent signals that you have is as high as possible. And then the next challenge is to transfer this technology from yeast or E. coli to mammalian cells, and then from mammalian cells, hopefully, to animals.
Okay.
None of which has been done.
You would start in test and model organisms first until you find the optimized delivery
and amplification in the case of a signal you're trying to amplify, reporting on the concentration of zinc, for instance, inside the cell. So you want that if there's a change in zinc due to some stimulation of the cell and the intracellular zinc is increasing, that you want the fluorescent signal to be reporting on that change in content of zinc inside the cell, and you want this amplification to be as high as possible so that the range is as wide as possible. And existing proteins just cannot do that. First, there's no existing protein that can be both fluorescent and bind zinc, so you have to create artificial proteins, and then you have to try many, many different ways, many different engineered proteins that would have the largest amplification of this zinc stimulation signal. And when that is done, then there's going to be challenges that haven't been tackled of how to transfer, if you will, this technology to mammalian cells and then from there, hopefully, to animals.
I would like to take a minute here to thank Audible.com for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. If you're in the U.S., you can download a free audiobook from over 35,000 titles by going to audible.com/twit. Now this week, my pick was DNA, The Secret of Life by James Watson. And as most Fib listeners probably know, James Watson and Francis Crick solved the structure of DNA, the double helix, over 50 years ago. I think Watson, he was 24 at the time. He was under 25. Now, what I find amazing about this story, what's truly amazing, is that Watson and Crick alone, for a couple of hours, understood how life worked better than anyone else had since the beginning of time. While Watson in this book goes far beyond the double helix, and he talks about how biotechnology has evolved into what it is today. So if you want to download DNA, The Secret of Life, just head over to audible.com/twit and pick up your free audiobook. Now, the best part of this is that, well, of course, if you like the service, you just stay subscribed. But if you don't, you just cancel and you get to keep the book. So back to the interview.
Do you guys share a lab or are there teams that share lab space or is every methodology either used by the materials guys or the geneticists or biochemists separated? Or I mean, it must be just absolutely fascinating to work together to, on one hand, make the genetic constructs, to pass it off to the materials guy that he then encapsulates these for delivery or gets cells from the biologist, puts them onto a matrix, and follows it up. I was just wondering if you, Peter, and Dennis have a common lab space that you...
We, in terms of the institute, the... most of the lab space, since we have such a large number of faculty, is the lab space of individual faculty.
Okay.
One of the things that we've noticed just in the last couple of years, literally, is that as students are becoming more multidisciplinary, they're the catalysts of change in the sense that they're the ones in the life sciences and medical research labs who are bringing the materials and engineering capabilities into their labs. Similarly, it's the graduate students in the engineering and physical sciences labs who, through our training programs, for example, and co-advising on projects, who are bringing in the expertise from the cell biology expertise, who are starting to bring that into their own labs. So it's actually very interesting to see this. There is we're seeing more of this cross-fertilization and more of this cross-pollination of disciplines, and it's mainly the students who are the catalyst for doing that.
Well, biologists have been using imaging techniques for decades, you know, scanning EM or transmission EM. So they must be really sort of the intermediates of this new field. Okay, Leo, can you pause that?
Yeah,
okay, we've never really had to pause. So normally the topics that we discuss, I have somewhat of a background. This is really cutting edge stuff, and I'm kind of
You want me to ask the stupid questions?
that's
my forte.
I'm good at stupid questions too. I'm sort of trying to pull together here. Well, maybe we should just leave it rolling. This is the real stuff too. What I think is really exciting is some of the examples of nanobiotech, so that people can visualize some.
Yeah, I think so far we're pretty abstract. So that's exactly right. I'd like to really get some specifics in here.
Yeah,
you know, I always thought I always thought nanotech was kind of, you know, shall I say, bogus. I mean, let's put it this way: the stuff of sci-fi. How can you make stuff that's molecular sized and actually do something? I can see the advantage.
Right, Leo? Those nanowires that Lindqvist was working on?
Yeah, but she didn't do anything with them. They're structural, but what do you do with them? So first of all, the challenges of working at this level must be extraordinary.
I think from the nanotechnology point of view, people have been working in nanotechnology for many, many years now. And it's interesting that the major breakthroughs here came largely in the mid to late 80s with imaging techniques that allows people routinely to be able to look at matter with the magnification sufficient to be able to see what you're making. So in nanotechnology, one of the main challenges is actually finding what you've made after you've made it.
And it's so small you lose
it. Exactly. So it is literally finding what you've made after you've made it and finding out if it's what you thought you made.
Wow.
And literally it's only in the last 20 years or so that we've had routine techniques with the sufficient magnification to be able to do that. And that's what's been, I think, the major breakthrough.
Now, when you're talking about nanobiotech, are you actually fabricating things at this point, or is it still a research level?
Yeah, there's many, many people fabricating things. They can be anything from, as we've already mentioned, fabricating nanoparticles or nanowires that maybe serve as vehicles for drug delivery. Right the way through to extensions of conventional microelectronics technology, which is merging with the sort of lab on a chip kind of technologies to bring new capabilities at very small length scales for those kind of diagnostic techniques.
For instance, high throughput methodologies that you may have heard of microfluidics, where you can really utilize very small amounts of reagents and probe many types of molecules. In this case, for instance, you can look at as a way of developing microfluidics tools to very quickly decide if some bacterial is a strain you're trying to identify. And so there's people are developing tools that we would call still nanobiotechnology, that people may call it more like microtechnology because it's micron-sized, but we enclose this as part of a definition of nanobiotechnology.
What makes something nano versus micro?
That's a good question. In fact, I was at the patent office last week, and they're wrestling with this question as well. The purists would say that anything less than 100 nanometers is nanotechnology. The less rigid people would probably say anything less than a 1,000 nanometers or a micron is nanotechnology.
Yeah, well, that would seem logical, because if it's on nanometer scale,
it's all pretty small.
To a certain extent, I think it's irrelevant. I mean, it's interesting. You mentioned a few minutes ago about nanotechnology being science fiction, and I think it's very difficult to separate fact from fiction in this area, which is an interesting problem by itself. to give you a couple of examples, the read heads in every computer that was built since 1998, I think, are so-called giant magnetoresistance heads that are very thin layers of alternating magnetic and non-magnetic materials. And these layer thicknesses are literally just a few nanometers. So we're not talking tens or hundreds of nanometers, just a few atomic layers thick.
Well, of course, and our chips are 90 nanometer now, too.
That's right, So,
but these aren't exactly machines. And I think when we think of nanotech, we think of almost machines or molecular level machines, yes?
Well, I guess...
It doesn't have to be, I think.
Okay.
It depends on your perspective, but I think this is maybe also part of the difficulty in actually figuring out what is nanotechnology, and in fact, one of the questions that we're often asked is nanotechnology a revolution or an evolution of scientific and technological development? And I think our answer typically is it's neither. I think one of the exciting things to come out of nanotechnology, though, is that it's a common umbrella for many people to work on.
Right.
So now you have physicists and chemists and biologists and engineers working on the same problems under the umbrella of nanotechnology. are not only working on the same problems, but beginning to collaborate on some of these problems. And I think many of the advances that are occurring now and will occur in the future are this new interdisciplinary way of approaching problems that nanotechnology has been the vehicle for introducing.
It's certainly true that a lot of the speculation about nanotech is nanobiology, things like cell scrubbers and bloodstream scrubbers, drug delivery techniques, things like that. These are all biotech.
Yeah. That's right.
Let me ask you, so it often refers to, you know, making trillions of particles that are very, very small, but how about experiments where you take and monitor maybe a single protein attached to a substrate and actually watching it work or modifying it so that it does a specific job? Is that being done, and where do you see that going? To use it as a tool for experimental biology, for example, single particle.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, a major component of one of the goals of the Institute is to develop new biophysical tools to help cell biologists interrogate cells in, you know, at the subcellular level and really try to understand better how proteins work, for instance, or small molecules inside the cell work, and really transpose some of the technology that has been developed to watch how individual proteins work, but in a way in a test tube outside of the cellular context, really try to now transfer this technology, and there's many challenges to the cellular level, and develop better microscopy approaches, to develop better analysis and even software, so that we can, you know, acknowledge the fact that, you know, proteins still have their own individuality, and not all proteins will all function the exact same way at the exact same time, that there's clearly a subpopulation of proteins that may be inactive and some others that are active inside the cell. And to acknowledge that and to study that, you need higher resolution and spatial and temporal resolution. You need better microscopies. You need maybe nanoparticles that you can tether to the protein of interest that you would be able to better track than actually tracking the proteins themselves. Of course, you have to ensure that this attachment of this nanoparticle doesn't change the function of the protein. And many cell biologists at Hopkins are really excited to work with engineers and physicists to develop such tools and really understand how individual proteins work in cells and then eventually in animals. I think that that is more nanotechnology for biology as opposed to nanotechnology for medicine. But clearly there's a lot of excitement among cell biologists that I think should be met. I think we're approaching single protein resolution inside cells very rapidly.
Denis, well, why don't you give an example of some of your quantum dot work to give a specific example of that?
Yeah, I think so. One of the problems of tracking proteins is that the fluorescent tag you may attach to that protein is typically not emitting enough light that you can watch it under a regular, even a fancy microscope. And clearly, the advent of quantum dots, which are now have much higher photobleaching threshold. That means that if you throw in a lot of light at them, they're not going to just die on you and photobleach and not allow you to continue monitoring the dynamics of that particle.
What are these?
The advent of these inorganic materials. They're not made of polymers. They're made of metals, and the confinement, what's called the quantum confinement, makes it so that you have now the emission of a fluorescent light that then can be looked at using a regular microscope, and now it is almost routine. No, there's maybe 10 labs in the world who can do it, but to actually
in your
monitor almost routine, you know, as soon as you have 10 labs, it's routine in science, as you know. But if that are able to really watch the movements of nanoparticles, then of course the next thing they want to do is to attach, tether a protein of interest to these quantum dots, so that now you can watch the protein movement as opposed to the quantum. So the quantum dot attached to the protein would report on the movement of the proteins. Of course, one has to be careful with that because, as I said earlier, you don't want this the presence of the quantum dots being tethered to the proteins affecting really the motion and even the function of the protein. But I think that better, you know, simply merely watching the movement of the quantum dots is interesting. But what researchers in the institute are thinking of doing is now even making biosensors that would be really based on quantum dot technology, where the attachment or the binding of some protein of interest to a quantum dot would modulate its fluorescence. And now you can use this quantum dot as a reporter of a binding event taking place inside the cell. For instance, there's some enzymes that become activated upon stimulation of a cell, for instance, in the context of some immunological response. And now you'd like to be able to say which part of the cell weighs this enzyme, so which part of the cell contains this enzyme, and better, which part of the cell has activated enzymes that are now functioning, and how do they function, and how many are functioning, can be done, or at least people are thinking of now using quantum dots as a way to report on those molecular events taking place inside a single cell under a microscope.
This would, I guess, replace a lot of the radioactivity that was used generally in the past to track biological events inside a cell.
That's right, and really going beyond some almost anatomic description of the cells. A lot of people are using green fluorescent protein technology. I think that that is proved to be a huge success. For the first time in the last few years, cell biologists have been finally able to watch the function of proteins in real time. But there's major issues associated with green fluorescent proteins. I thought there's still a lot of development to be made, but they tend to photobleach very quickly. It means that at if you throw in lights at them, they tend to photobleach and then disappear. You don't know where they are anymore. But
they burn up.
Yeah. They burn out, so to speak. And quantum dots have a disadvantage of their own, which is that there's some evidence that they are not always, you know, very biocompatible. That means that injecting such quantum dots inside cells may kill the cell. But people are working really diligently to try to render these quantum dots much more biocompatible, and I think people are finding solutions. So the next thing is, of course, would be now to make them a little bit more interesting and more intelligent by doing some of the things I explained of tethering some binding domain on the surface of the quantum dots and really monitoring, for instance, enzymatic functions in real time in living cells, or even better, in vivo in live animals. You by coupling the imaging with for instance, radiologists would be able to use powerful fluorescence microscopes or other instruments to monitor the functioning of proteins inside a single cell, inside a tissue, inside an animal, really to be able to recapitulate as closely as possible the physiological or pathological situation.
Could you do this in vivo, do the microscopy without harming or sort of resulting in an end of life? And if so, could you sort of attach an antibody that's specific to one type of cancer and attach also the drug and then put the quantum dot tethered and just make sure that the drug's getting to the right place?
There's several groups in the world who are thinking on those lines. Some proofs of principles have been developed now to extend the use of quantum dots for therapeutic uses. That hasn't, as far as I know, hasn't been done yet. And people at Hopkins and other labs are really working hard to at least develop some proofs of principle of this multifunctionality that you're talking about. You know, targeting of specific tissues, monitoring using the quantum dot ability of fluorescing of emitting light at very high intensity, so you can monitor them more easily than classical means such as radio labeling, and at the same time also delivering a drug of interest. And those things done together, as far as I know, hasn't been done.
On another note, so one thing that I find interesting, well, is the fact that while if you look at nature and you take a look at all the materials that are available in nature, in terms of non-organic, there's not that many machines that have ever been developed. It took a monkey to use a stick to go get ants to create the first machine or first tool. But on the other end, if you look at living organisms, each cell, each protein complex is in fact a molecular machine. So the biologists actually have a fantastic access to tools and machines that are just unbelievable. Millions and millions of different kinds of machines. So if they can,
that's a good point. Nature got there first, didn't it?
Yeah, nature, absolutely. Yeah.
Optimized it by using evolution, right? So those machines are now incredibly optimum in the efficiency and efficacy, absolutely.
And while engineers on the other side who've been trying to build them have developed fantastic methodology. So I think by combining, the true engineering to some of these biological systems, you're getting to the next level of true bioengineering or biotechnology. Do you guys foresee this? I mean, I know the focus is very pragmatic at Johns Hopkins to tackle disease, but could you ever foresee the other way around, using the motor that turns a flagella on an E. coli to driving molecular machines in for other purposes?
There's certainly many faculty here at Hopkins working on various aspects of those kind of things. To give you one example, a colleague of mine, Kalina Rostova, is working on trying to build artificial cell membranes in which can be inserted membrane proteins, with the objective of trying to create an artificial membrane with a fully functioning membrane channel, let's say, that can be detected by some external means, whether it's by an electrical signal or optical signal, for example. So that's certainly one example of trying to do something like that. There are also examples, as Denis knows, since we have a small collaboration in this area of trying to use, for example, actin polymerization, and there's many other people around the world trying to do this as motors, for example, for nanoparticles.
And this field is called biomimetism. We're inspired by nature, and using these very efficient machines you were talking about, trying to, for instance, utilize motor proteins as a means of moving around reagents inside channels or microfluidic channels. I know of groups at University of Washington and also in Europe working together to try to exploit these highly efficient motor proteins to move around microtubules or actin filaments inside channels that have been patterns using microfabrication means. Now, some of the uses can be rather esoteric, but I think there's still promise to use some of those technologies as for diagnostic tools, for instance, high throughput diagnostic tools to quickly identify bacterial strains and other pathogens, for instance. So I can foresee in mid and long term that people would use these fantastic machines, these molecular motors taken directly from the cell, if you will, as a way to move around reagents and create even decision trees of identification to quickly identify some pathogen within some complex fluid taken from blood sample or something like that.
Do you also look at ways to kind of partner with the body's own processes? It's often used as an example that ATP would be used to power these molecular engines because it's there as an energy source.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, some of those motor proteins require ATP. And yes, that would be a So the cost is ATP, but these machines are so efficient that they beat every existing man-made machines, as far as I know, in terms of efficiency. There's, people talk about 80 or 90% efficiency, and I think that's been the motivation for behind using motor proteins as opposed to maybe MEMS, micro MEMS, which are these micro machines that are really made of hard materials that are not organic, create moving nano machines and the likes.
Are you doing some MEMS stuff, or is that not part of what the INBT is doing?
I can't. I mean, some of the participating faculty are looking at MEMS, but I don't think it's a special emphasis of the institute.
Your correct? Stuff is more biological and
oh, very biological. Yeah, it's medicine. We have to acknowledge the competition. Undeniably, places like Northwestern and Penn State, Stanford, MIT have built a really unbelievable and well-deserved reputation in nanotechnology. Where we come in is really biology and medicine, and rather surprisingly, there's somewhat and many efforts going on, but they're very they're somewhat disorganized. Here we really have a very concerted effort to tackle hard problems, typically medical problems. We mentioned cystic fibrosis. There's questions in ovarian and lung cancer where we believe nanotechnology is the answer, and we tackling it from a training angle where we want students to be quickly learn the jargon, the techniques, in both in physical and biological sciences, bringing together faculty. And in a way, be ready to tackle those bigger questions where not one group can solve them, really.
If you, Denis and Peter, were to be betting men, which of the technologies you're working on now seem most likely to come to fruition first? Any horses you want to bet on?
I think these multifunctional nanoparticles, I think 5-10 years from now, they look like what were these guys, people doing before that? I mean, they'll think come to fruition and they'll be optimized so that they're biocompatible, so that they can, they don't produce false negatives and false positives, which is always, of course, an issue. Definitely an issue in ovarian cancer, where you know diagnostic is the issue. I think in that context, and I think I know that faculty at Hopkins are working of really make the equivalent of what's now been established in the prostate cancer. In the case of PSA, try to discover target molecules that are secreted specifically by ovarian cancer cells, and now find ways to very specifically and detect very small amounts of these molecules that are secreted by ovarian cancers to very early on detect onset of ovarian cancer. And I, if I have to bet, going back to your question, I would say that those nanoparticles, and I cannot bet on a shape. They can be nanowires, spherical. I cannot tell. But
well, we won't put you on the spot there. We'll get you off the hook on that.
I see these nanoparticles as almost being, you know, synthetic viruses of sorts or engineered viruses, even though they're not replicating, which is probably the best part of them.
That's right. You don't really want them to replicate, or you get the gray goo syndrome.
It looks like the nanobiotechnologists are also borrowing a little bit from living or pseudo living mechanisms out there, or systems, which is it's kind of interesting. So, you know, a combination of evolution generating millions of various machines, and then borrowing from those to sort of like Velcro. I hate to use a very crude example, but you know, if you walk through a field in the late summer, you know that.
So these are going to be used primarily for diagnostic. Is that the purposes?
Therapeutics. If we have now a drug that can be attached to these particles that can report on, you know, the onset of a disease at the same time, you know, if it detects, and there's going to be all kinds of details that have to be worked out. But if instead of waiting for these nanoparticles to decide if, you know, once that's rather if the nanoparticles has decided, yes, you know, here's some ovarian cancer tumor to quickly deliver a chemotherapeutic drug, for instance.
Let's get it, boys. Yeah. Would it be drug delivery? Is that the kind of thing it would do, or would it have?
This is a major.
Could you do both? Could you find the target and then use your sort of?
Yes, but I'm talking about the therapeutic side of it. What kinds of therapies would?
So drugs, but also genes. In the context of gene therapy, it can be deliver a drug, and that would be a drug delivery. But it can be also a gene delivery, where you not deliver the proper normal gene and try to replace this mutant gene or missing gene. That's very much the context of cystic fibrosis, where the only cure that we can think of that would be long term would be a gene therapeutic approach to the problem. And one of the big problems of gene therapy has been the side effects, and part of the side effect is because there's a little targeting going on that all cells are being delivered this gene, and some cells really the last thing they want to see is some cystic fibrosis receptor gene being activated, and you want to target specific lung cells that are diseased and not, you know, deliver these genes all over the place. So hence you have to engineer the surface of these particles so that these particles, if they stray away from the cancer cell, are just eliminated by natural elimination, and those that are in the proximity of the disease cells would be homing in a directed fashion towards these cells, because expressing ligands that will bind very specifically other little molecules being attached on the surface of the nanoparticles. So it's really a combination of specificity of drug or gene delivery and making sure, of course, that the complex nanoparticles plus all these particles or these proteins coated on the particles are actually still biocompatible, because again, you don't want to kill your patient or in the beginning your laboratory mouse or rat.
Putting your minds together, there's no question that you guys will achieve your goals. What do you think the time frame is before these hit market or available?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer, because it involves factors that are beyond the control of the researchers and the clinicians here. But certainly I think there'll be many developments that over the next 5 to 10 years will be reaching clinical trials. And then what happens beyond that, of course, is outside our control.
Yeah, but some of those platforms, such as the nanoparticles, and could be used by researchers in a context or in application that we don't even imagine or we don't even envision here at Hopkins, and in a way making those available should accelerate the development of nanotechnologies that could be used in medicine and biology that we're not even forcing, and making available many different tools could be a way to enhance especially complexes, nanoparticles that for instance that could be used for clinical applications. So I think that's going to be one way that the impact of the institute is going to be felt.
Wow. This is, I'm still, I have no clue how far that you guys are going to be able to take this. The institute in 25 years from now will be, I just can't imagine what you guys will be developing. It'll be pretty wild. I'd like to put some links in the show notes, so at futuresinbiotech.blogspot.com. I'm going to put some links to some of the images of the materials you guys are working with and some of the projects, because I think it will really help people to get an understanding of what you're doing, where you're going with some of these images, because they're really pretty cool. Leo?
Yeah, well, I just want to thank Denis and Peter for joining us, because it's a peek into the future of nanobiotech, and it seems to make sense that you have to do a team this big and this interdisciplinary to even attempt to tackle the kind of things that you're tackling. I mean, just revolutionary ideas. Yeah,
it's thinking out of the box. It's definitely thinking out of the box. It's sort of not using necessarily traditional approaches of just modifying the biochemistry with a drug or going in with a traditional gene transfer methodology, which haven't been that effective, or gene silencing. I mean,
And thanks to JHU for putting it together. And of course, I know Barbara Mikulski was instrumental as well. In getting the funding for this. So that's great.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, thank
well,
you.
Well, Mark, Leo, thank you so much for the opportunity. I think I've appreciated every minute of it. It was very interesting, and I'm learning more and more about how podcasting really works.
Yeah, new media is great for this stuff because it allows you the time and the freedom to talk, but also to talk kind of a little more technically. And there are a lot of people interested in this who just aren't getting served by mainstream media. So I'm glad we could do this. I mean, we have 20 or 30,000 people who really want to know how this stuff works and want to hear it from the people who are doing it.
This is going to have more impact if even half that number actually listen to us or going to care to listen to us. That's going to be more impact than any paper in Science or Nature would do. It's just
right.
Remarkable.
It spreads the word about what's going on. And I mean, I think those people are influencers who then go out and say, hey, I heard this thing on biotech and – and the problem I've had with mainstream media is that we just have to dumb it down so much that it's almost useless. It almost ends up being, oh, you're going to have little scrubbing bubbles in your bloodstream that'll and it doesn't, I think our audience anyway wants to hear a little bit more detail about what that means. So thank you very much. I look forward to
thank you so much.
I look forward to talking to you again in a year and a couple of years hence to see how much progress you've made.
Come back for an update.
We will, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, we'd be happy to do it.
Great. Peter Searson, Director, Denis Wirtz, Associate Director of the Institute for Nanobiotechnology. And now that they're gone, just between you and me, Mark, is this a unique effort? I mean, is there anybody anywhere else in the world doing this kind of vast, giant, interdisciplinary project?
Well, there are other institutes working on nanobiotechnology, and there's an association. So there are maybe 1,000 scientists working around the world on it. They have an interesting focus at Johns Hopkins, and that is to apply nanobiotechnology to medicine. So that's really where they're pretty unique.
Right. It's just really exciting to think about what we're looking at in the next decade or so. I mean, just when they describe a machine in your bloodstream that can find ovarian cancer, and then apply just to that one cell the appropriate chemotherapy, what a revolution that'll be. It'll make the experience of chemotherapy completely different from the patient's point of view.
It'll also allow the patient to know that the drug is working because
on that cell and no other cell.
On the
cell.
Right cell. Yeah. So it'll be pretty cool. I think no more hair falling out.
I mean, no more. It's just amazing. Let's do the disclaimers because I know Yale would want you to.
Yes. So the ideas and opinions expressed here do not reflect those of Yale University or the Yale School of Medicine. There's also a couple of people I'd like to thank.
Before you do, I just want to say Bula Bula. Okay, now go ahead.
I'd like to thank Sue Porterfield for helping us set up the interviews. I'd like to thank Harry Gill and Mark Parker for reviewing the show notes, and Will Hall for the theme to Fib.
I'm still liking it. You like it? I'm still liking it. We have a number of podcasts coming up, so if people want to send us their ideas for themes for any of the new podcasts we've got this week in law. Although I think we've got some pretty good choices for that one, but I do need some for our Windows podcast, which is coming soon, the Vista podcast.
Do you sleep, Leo?
We get Robert Fripp to do those. I haven't been sleeping a lot lately, and it's either the number of podcasts or the new espresso machine in the Twit offices. One or the other.
Fantastic.
But I am hiring an assistant now, thanks to the generous donations of our Twit army. I want to remind you that now that you hear ads on Twit, that doesn't mean we don't still need your support. Your support goes to the infrastructure, that is the bandwidth, the web hosting, the equipment. All of the stuff that makes the podcast possible. And the reason we're doing it this way is so that we can channel the advertising into the pockets of people like Mark, the contributors who make the content possible. So that's kind of the division of labor. Your donations go to infrastructure, and the advertising money will go towards salaries, actually paying people who have been doing this volunteer work all this time. Mark, it's great to talk to you. We've got many more fascinating interviews coming up. Please, people, visit the show notes because I think you'll get a lot more information out of those. That is futuresinbiotech.blogspot.com. Mark does a great job on those. And we do appreciate your feedback. We want to hear from you. Let us know. Put comments in the show. That's the easiest way for us to see it is go to twit.tv. You do need to register, but it's free. And then you can put, and we do that just to avoid spam. And then you could put comments after each show. And I know Mark reads those religiously, maybe a little too religiously.
I do. I'm addicted.
I hear from him. But we
also,
do
yeah,
good
people
and bad.
Record too. If they on Futures in Biotech, that's our username on Skype. So if they want to call Skype and leave a message.
Send a message. Yep.
Yeah. We've got some questions that have been recorded. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, we'll include them in future shows.
Mark Pelletier, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Futures in Biotech.
Thanks again.
Plus ça change, la plus ça change, la plus la même chose. But it's actually la plus ça change, c'est la même chose. Or something like that.
Another Belgian on the other line.
Le plus ça change, le plus la même chose. It never sounds very good, actually, but... It always sounds grammatically incorrect.
It does, doesn't it? It's Proust, though, so it has to be right.
Yeah, you're right. You got it right, Leo, on the show.
Did I? Well, le plus ça change, le plus le même chose.
He was wrong. You got it right.
Really? Yeah.